vous souhaiter tous le bienvenu et vous remercier d'être participants et participantes dans cette conférence fascinante et particulièrement en ce qui concerne un sujet qui me tient personnellement beaucoup à cœur, qui est la question des institutions de droit de la personne. I just want to make a very quick note about terminology and then how we propose to proceed with your permission. This session is going to run until 12:30, so we have a fair bit of time for all of our participants. And we're going to go in sequence, starting from an NGO perspective through to national institutions of different kinds, and there's quite a diversity around the table. And then we're going to close with the academic perspective, which Professor Frédéric Maigret is going to bring to the table. A couple of words about terminology. I'm a lawyer, and human rights, when I hear the term human rights institutions, I tend to think of national or regional institutions. And that reflects my own experience to some extent. But in fact, there is a large variety and wealth and richness of different institutions that have human rights mandates that range from informal associations to non-governmental organizations to national human rights institutions that have a statutory body, statutory basis, institutions that may have a multiple mandate. For example, there are human rights institutions around the world who take care of human rights, maladministration, environmental issues. There are institutions that only deal with anti-discrimination matters, such as those in Canada, the United States, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. There are institutions that have jurisdiction, statutory jurisdiction, over the full range of human rights as reflected in universal human rights instruments. There are regional human rights institutions that have a statutory basis as well in the sense of a memorandum of understanding or shared statutory jurisdiction in a large region of the world, for example, in the African context, and we have somebody here with expertise in that area as well. Moving on from that, we have UN institutions, or the United Nations, which has been a promoter of and a supporter of and a strengthener of national institutions at the international level. And I've been involved as a lawyer as counsel for respondents to human rights complaints. I've been a senior manager in human rights commissions in Canada and internationally. I've represented plaintiffs. I've worked with the United Nations helping to set up some of these institutions in the broad sense of that term, not necessarily statutory institutions, but other ones. I've had the opportunity to work with and be party to human rights proceedings. So I've had the opportunity to see these institutions from pretty much every perspective. And what you see as you move through these different layers is that there really is a wide range of and multiplicity of institutions that are doing very, very different work, but whose work is also profoundly and organically, if I could use that term, interconnected. And there are some really fundamental questions given the valuable role that these institutions play around the world. Are they working? Does the multiplicity of these institutions make sense? Do we have too many? Do they overlap? How do the different roles fit together? How do they interact with each other? Is it complementary or is it fundamentally an antagonistic relationship? So these are the kinds of things I would like our panelists to think about today, and these are the kinds of things I'd like you to think about today as you're listening to these presentations. We're going to start with where I think is the natural place for this to start. It also happens to have been the first person I spoke with when I came in the room, which is the NGO perspective. And the reason why I'd like to start with the NGO perspective is because to some extent, well, of course, first of all, NGOs preceded national institutions just from a historical perspective. The concept that you would have a socially based organization that would act as a defender of human rights, of course, preceded any statutorily based institution pretty much anywhere in the world. And also, to some extent, at the international level, human rights institutions in the statutory sense were introduced to kind of be a buffer between NGOs and governments. Right. So when you think about the way that human rights commissions, even though they're government bodies, function, their most significant respondents are, of course, the governments themselves. Right. So they're in this weird relationship with both their own funders and their institutional supporters on the one hand. They're often in a confrontational relationship with the NGO community. The NGO community has a mandate which is completely different, which is to work with and support civil society within the framework of their mission and mandate. And they have an agility and a flexibility and a capacity to move and to be consistent with their constituencies in a way that no governmental organization does. So that's the reason I'd like to start with the NGO perspective. And from that perspective, I would like to introduce Paula, now is it Schrieffer? Okay. Who is the Director of Advocacy with Freedom House. Now, I have been instructed by the participants here, the speakers today, not to read you all their bios. So I'm not going to do that in order to give them a little bit of time. But what I would like to ask them to do before they sort of launch into the subject is to give a brief overview of what they think is important about the organization they're involved with, where the priorities are, and how they see it fitting into this organization. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Paula.
Great. Thanks so much for the introduction. As we've just heard, NGOs did, in fact, precede most of the national institutions, and Freedom House is actually the oldest human rights organization in the United States. So we were established way back in 1941. We'll be celebrating our 70th anniversary next year. And I have to say, we have so far not succeeded in filling our mandate of completely spreading freedom and human rights throughout the world, although we keep trying, and I think we've done a pretty good job in some places. Freedom House is perhaps best known for our annual surveys of political rights and civil liberties. We have a publication which is geniusly titled Freedom in the World that we've been putting out every year since 1972 that looks at every country in the world and not only provides a narrative description of the state of human rights, but also provides a grade, a scorecard of how those countries are doing, a comparison of how they do towards one another, and as well as we can look at and see how they've performed over time. We also have a survey, annual survey, that looks exclusively at press freedom, that being such a fundamental institution in supporting all of the other political rights and civil liberties. We've been putting that out for a little over 30 years now, and also we look at every country in the world. But Freedom House does a lot of other things besides publications. In fact, most of our work at the organization, most of our funding goes towards running programs where we actively work and support human rights defenders and civil society activists throughout the world. We do a lot of work in particularly closed societies, which can be a very difficult environment to work in. But I'm going to start by sort of, in good Freedom House fashion, laying out sort of the global framework for the context under which human rights defenders are currently working. For those who have been following Freedom House's annual surveys of political rights and civil liberties, you will have some idea of what our assessment has been of this context. For those who are not familiar, we have now tracked four straight years of far more declines in freedom and political rights and civil liberties than we have seen in increases around the world. And in particular, we have seen declines in freedom of expression and freedom of association. And I want to highlight that this is happening in almost every region of the world, and it's happening in both democracies and autocracies and countries that we rate as free as well as in countries that we rate completely not free. The rights of individuals to share information, to express their thoughts and their opinions, whether through private correspondence, through public work, published works, through blogs, through peaceful demonstrations, are being threatened by a broad array of legalistic, political, and economic pressures, as well as by violence from both state and non-state actors. The current context includes an aggressive pushback against these fundamental freedoms by a number of important and strategically powerful countries, including many allies of the United States. It is also complicated by the legacy that I think continues to influence us, which is the legacy of the George Bush administration, which has given rise to a lot of questions among democracies about whether and when and if we should best promote democracy and human rights outside of our borders. I would say that is also further complicated by the continuing economic downturn, which I would say has done real damage to the image of liberal democracies, particularly the United States, and it has led some to question about the credibility of promoting these values outside of borders. I would also note the authoritarian model, particularly the China model, I would say has grown somewhat in its appeal, not only to other authoritarian governments, but I think it's grown in appeal to publics around the world who are legitimately concerned about their level of prosperity as much as they are concerned about their fundamental human rights. Now, I think it's important to note that, by and large, the declines that we've seen globally have not typically been massive shifts, not massive declines on our big 100-point scale. So we've not seen a huge shift, for instance, of countries moving from the free to the partly free or from the partly free into the not free category. But, again, we've seen about double the declines than we've seen increases, and we've seen it globally now for 4 years straight. To give you a sense of what we're talking about, to put it a little bit in context, I want you to consider the following. In 2009, Freedom House recorded declines in global press freedom through our press freedom survey for the eighth year in a row, with setbacks in also every single region of the world, again, democracies and authoritarian countries alike. In fact, we recorded the sharpest declines in sub-Saharan Africa and in Latin America, which is actually the second freest environment in the world for press overall. While Latin America is home to only two countries that Freedom House currently ranks not free in press freedom, Venezuela and Cuba, Freedom House recorded significant press freedom declines in a number of middle-performing countries and modest declines in countries that were already performing poorly. So to give a few examples, in Ecuador, the government heightened controls and threats to punish media outlets for, quote, irresponsible content. Mexico witnessed a significant rise in violence against journalists and continued impunity for their attackers. Constitutional protections for press freedom were suspended in Honduras following the ouster of President Zelaya. Countries like Colombia and Guatemala, which already rank fairly low on our partly free category, continued to fare poorly with high levels of intimidation against journalists. The picture in sub-Saharan Africa was far bleaker, with declines in press freedom recorded in a range of countries, again, from the most to the least free. Due to increased government pressure and rhetoric, previous top performers, countries like Namibia, countries like South Africa, slipped for the first time in over a decade from our free into our partly free category. This is the first time that we've recorded since 1980 not having any fully free press countries in southern Africa. This is significant. In addition, throughout the continent, we saw problems. Intimidating prosecution, arrest, jailing of journalists led to declines in countries from Senegal to Niger, Uganda, which seems to be copying everything Ethiopia does, to Eritrea. In addition to South Africa, another and outside of the African continent, another previously ranked free country, Italy, dropped back into the partly free category. So you're seeing that this is happening all over the world. As we heard in yesterday's media session, Canada, the U.S., continue to have challenges in their press freedom, although we still rank them in the free category. Countries like the United Kingdom still have one of the most problematic libel laws in the globe, giving them the notorious title as the libel tourism capital of the world. On the freedom of association side, recent years have shown also far more declines than gains. According to our friends at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, just last year, in 2009, 27 countries considered or enacted legal measures to constrain civic space. 27 countries. This is on top of countries who already had enacted restrictive NGO legislation, such as Russia, Egypt, Venezuela, and others. These countries, again, arrange. Countries like Ecuador, Ethiopia, I'll talk a little bit more about, Honduras, Nicaragua, Paraguay, Peru, Sudan, Uganda, Venezuela, Zambia, Zimbabwe, all of these countries have now copied restrictive NGO legislation. Typically, this legislation is under the pretext of guaranteeing security or political stability, social harmony, it's sometimes called. Governments have been putting in place these legal restrictions on NGO activities that make it difficult for organizations to register, to communicate with one another, and in particular to obtain funding, particularly foreign funding, which in many of these countries is the only way that even charitable organizations can continue to survive. It is, of course, particularly crippling for organizations that do human rights monitoring or serve a watchdog function. There is almost no way for those organizations to get domestic funding due to intimidation. Often, this legislation is written in very broad, vague terms, which provides governments with tremendous discretion and leeway in terms of how they prosecute. Talk a little bit more about Ethiopia, which is an extreme case. The very existence of civil society, not just human rights organizations, is at stake with their law. The implementation of what they call the Charities and Societies Proclamation Act in 2009 has caused most human rights organizations to simply abandon their work. Only about 10 genuine civil society groups actually were able to re-register as Ethiopian charities capable of carrying out human rights work, and they are required by law to generate not more than 10% of their funding from foreign sources. This will make it impossible. They will essentially go out of business. Yet, I should say that restrictions to fundamental human rights are not only happening at the country level. A number of countries have been attempting to limit civil society participation in international organizations and institutions, and have been attempting to create legal mechanisms that restrict speech as well at these institutions. In 2009, Venezuela and Nicaragua actually succeeded in blocking the participation of a number of local NGOs from the General Assembly meeting that year. And last year, Venezuela attempted to insert language into a resolution that would have essentially given any state veto power over which organizations were able to go and attend the General Assembly and other OAS functions. OAS is, of course, the oldest regional organization in the world. It took a substantial advocacy effort to push back that, get that language withdrawn, but it was done. At the UN, of course, repressive organizations very cleverly fill the seats of the Committee on Non-Governmental Organizations, which oversees the accreditation process through which NGOs are able to participate in that institution. And what they do is they harass, even if the groups get registered in the first place. It took Freedom House 3 years to get accredited back in 1995. We had first applied in 1992, and it took a massive amount of advocacy and lobbying directly to governments to make sure that we got accredited. Many organizations simply don't have the capacity to do that. Even once you get in, organizations are finding themselves harassed on an annual basis by endless lists of questions through which countries, particularly in our case, China, Cuba, to some extent the Sudan and Russia, attempt to trip you up to try to get you to provide any language that will give them an excuse to say that you are a politicized organization, that you are selective in your criticisms, which would be an excuse to withdraw or suspend your status. They have been consistently rejecting the applications of LGBT organizations, and oftentimes it requires these groups to go to the full Economic and Social Council to override those votes to then get their accreditation. So it's a real process. Harassment at the UN, however, doesn't only take place at the NGO committee level. It also takes place directly during Human Rights Council sessions, where a number of governments repeatedly interrupt NGOs as they try to make oral interventions during the council sessions. At just this last session in September, Freedom House had accredited two individuals to speak on human rights abuses in Libya and another individual to speak on Somalia. One of the women, who is one of the nurses who was held for over 8 years in Libya and tortured extensively, was interrupted 5 different times by Iran, Libya, Cuba, and China. It took 18 minutes for her to get through a 2-minute presentation, and it took extensive interventions by the U.S., the U.K., and the EU to even get the president of the council to allow her to continue making her presentation. Freedom of expression has likewise been under attack at the Human Rights Council. Several countries succeeded in changing the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression so that that person, in addition to reporting on the enabling environment for freedom of expression, actually now has to report on instances of hate speech, essentially, which is sort of turning the mandate upside down. In addition, there have been sustained attempts to create a legal mechanism that would make it make states required to pass legislation that would prevent people from saying things that could be considered offensive to religions. I should say that freedom of expression and association are by no means the only human rights that we've seen dropping. But because these fundamental rights have such a broad impact in other areas, they also have a detrimental impact on other human rights areas. So torture, fraudulent elections, arbitrary detention, violence against minorities, against religious minorities, ethnic minorities, women, all of these things, of course, are impacted by declines in freedom of expression and association. What is it that we do to combat this? What have been some of our successes and our failures? First of all, I think the most critical thing that we have to do is to remind one another and to remind all governments that, in fact, human rights are universal. There was a lot of discussion about this issue yesterday. I find it stunning that we still actually have to have these conversations. Yes, it is true that the current human rights mechanisms were largely put in place after World War II, and they were largely put in place by West European governments. However, it should be reminded that that was done because Europe was essentially soaked in blood from World War II and massive atrocities of which had never been seen before on the planet. It was a part of the world going back through history where human rights have not been generally respected, and in fact, had Freedom House been raiding any countries back when we were first founded in 1941, I don't know of many who would even be on our free list. So let's not pretend that the Western world is in any way more inclined to supporting human rights than any other part of the world on the planet. In fact, from my experience, typically the only people who will argue against the universality of human rights are governments, or in some cases religious leaders who find human rights, frankly, a threat to their ongoing ability to stay in power. Rarely will you ever hear human rights victims, certainly human rights defenders, talking about the need to contextualize human rights. And in fact, I think if you look at the UDHR, if you look at our Freedom in the World survey, which is derived from the UDHR, it's pretty common sense that people should have a right to express their views, to have their own religion, to participate in their governments. And opinion polls around the world, even in the most repressive societies, show that people believe that they should have these rights and that they want these rights, even if they can't articulate them in the language of international law. So we, of course, need to keep reminding everybody of this issue. We also need to continue working across border with one another. I would say that, by and large, Freedom House largely uses its accreditation at the UN not as a venue in particular where Freedom House needs to make its message heard, although we do that, but mainly we use it as a mechanism to bring human rights defenders directly from countries where massive human rights violations are taking place and allowing them to address the Council, to meet with the countries, and in particular to meet with what I believe are all of the international mechanisms' best tools, which are the special rapporteurs, the independent experts who both have country-specific as well as thematic mandates. For anybody who's read Freedom House's report cards on the UN Human Rights Council, you will know that we are not particularly happy with how the Council is functioning. However, we don't put out these criticisms to say that it is inherently a structural problem, that there is something inherently wrong with having a multilateral political body that looks at human rights. What we point out is that countries who have by and large, decent domestic human rights records are not doing their job, are not putting in enough political capital into the Council to make sure that this body is in turn doing what it's supposed to do, which is to protect and support human rights rather than to protect and support human rights abusers. It is not surprising that to anyone that repressive countries with poor human rights records want to sit on the Human Rights Council. Of course they do. It is in their interest to make sure that the Council is not singling them out for action. However, they are putting in more resources currently than countries with better human rights records into the Council. And what we have called for consistently is for an increased interest on behalf of democracies. Many of you may know that when the UN Human Rights Council was formed, the United States at first didn't even run for a seat on the council. They were upset because the council wasn't restructured like they wanted it to be. Okay, there could have been some structural changes that I would have liked to have seen. It is what it is. It's a political body. It will only behave as well as the countries that sit on it. We have strongly pushed the U.S. to change that position under the Obama administration. They have. They followed a number of recommendations. They appointed an ambassador-level position exclusively for the council that was important. And most importantly, they put in resources where they could go directly to capitals of other governments and say, hey, listen, this is as high a priority for us as the Security Council. This is as high a priority for us as the General Assembly, and that's what's needed. And this pressure, both from NGOs and from governments, who, by the way, I should point out, do not have perfect human rights records and do not always stand up on the right side of these issues, this pressure has led to some successes. At this past session, for instance, there was a resolution passed establishing a new mandate for a special rapporteur for the first time on freedom of assembly and peaceful association. This is a tremendous accomplishment. As I said, these special procedures have really been the most effective mechanisms that the Human Rights Council has to offer. It is not easy to create a new mechanism. Yes, this person will come under tremendous pressure. Their job will not be easy, and largely the council exists as an advocacy mechanism. It's an opportunity to highlight issues. But that is an opening that didn't exist before. And I will say countries care a great deal about what is said about them. If they didn't, they wouldn't invest so many resources in trying to suppress it. So I'm going to wrap up on a positive note and just remind everyone that despite all of these declines that we've been seeing over the past several years, you have to put it in the broader context. As I said at the beginning, in 1941, there are not too many countries on the planet that Freedom House would have even ranked free in any part of the world. Certainly in 1972, there was a much, much smaller number of free countries. And in 1980, the picture changed dramatically. Even where we are today with these years of declines, we still see a far more free world, a world that respects human rights, much more than took place even a couple of decades ago. So I want to end on that note and turn it over to my colleagues.
I'd like to thank Paula for that powerful and provocative overview of not only what one of North America's leading NGOs does, but also the kind of great overview of what's happening globally. Before I turn it over to Elizabeth, I'd like to make a couple of observations that I'd like you to think about in terms of Paula's presentation as we're moving forward, particularly as we move into the issue of religious freedom, which is what Elizabeth Cassidy is going to be speaking to us about. One of the sea changes in what human rights institutions do over the last, particularly I think in the last 10 to 15 years, has been thinking about human rights and the work that human rights institutions do, as a broader push towards equality rights as kind of an overarching objective. And so in Rwanda, for example, where I've worked, the media was actually used as probably one of the most powerful tools to achieve the genocide. And one of the reasons why international donor organizations at the time during the genocide didn't intervene to shut down Radio Télévision Midcolline, which was the media outlet, the radio outlet that was propagating directly or indirectly or inciting hatred and violence, was because some of the organizations who were involved, including the American government, who, as you know, was instrumental at the time in not intervening to shut down and jam the radio station, was on the grounds of free speech. In many countries that are not democratic, the role of the media is actually not an undiluted good. Many in the media are on the payroll of the government and work closely with the government. That's part of what Freedom House does to some extent, is to look at media freedom in that more nuanced context. The international human rights instruments that we have referred to briefly, of course, guarantee freedom of speech, and that must be your default position. There's also, since the inception of international human rights, guarantees of protection for the rights and reputations of others. Yeah, and that's as important, particularly to the victims of those who are targeted by this, as the initial right may be. At the same time, there are concerns that religious organizations are using or misusing free speech and other types of freedoms in a manner that may be perceived by some as antithetical to some of the objectives that we're talking about. And these create real, live, and interesting tensions, I think, in the way in which human rights institutions function. And I think it's a more nuanced and more challenging environment than it was 15, 20 years ago, and I think when a lot of these issues were seen as much more, much less complex in some senses. Some of these issues are emerging in a very different way. So with that kind of brief context setting, I'm very pleased to introduce Elizabeth Cassidy, who's the Deputy Director for Policy and Research of something called, and I never heard of it until this morning, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, which I understand is a statutory body. This is interesting in part because there are a number of human rights institutions with a statutory basis in the world that do have narrow mandates, i.e. that are not supportive of the full range of human rights and freedoms as set out in the Universal Instruments, but that are dedicated to a particular right and freedom. And it's particularly interesting for me given the strong U.S. Focus on traditional civil liberties, if you will, in the kind of post-Cold War sense of that term, on the one hand, that you even exist. So I would love to hear about what it is your organization does, and would like you to welcome Elizabeth Cassidy.
Thanks. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming, and to the organizers for inviting me to be here at this conference and to speak today. As you've heard, I work for something called the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a relatively small body, not especially well known, except by people who sort of work within the field. But I'll tell you a little bit about sort of how we came about and what we do, because we are, as you heard, statutorily mandated, but we are unlike most national human rights commissions in that we focus on not on domestic issues and on sort of a particular right. So the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which is often referred to as USCIRF, USCIRF, was created by Congress in 1998. The act that created it is called the International Religious Freedom Act, or IRFA, since everything seems to have an acronym. So, we're a unique entity within the U.S. government. We are independent and bipartisan. We're an advisory body. We are mandated to monitor religious freedom around the world and make policy recommendations to the President, Secretary of State, and Congress. The way this all came about in the 1990s is through initially a movement of civil society that was sort of advocating for increased U.S. focus on addressing persecution and promoting religious freedom around the world, that led to the proposal of an act in Congress. Essentially, there was a feeling among a number of members of Congress that U.S. Foreign policy's promotion of human rights was neglecting religious freedom, i.e., among the rights that were being promoted, religious freedom was being overlooked, and that this should be remedied, that religious freedom was an important human right, it was a significant American value, and it should be a more important part of U.S. foreign policy. The act was, as you might imagine, this proposal, as you might imagine, was somewhat controversial, although ultimately it was passed nearly unanimously by Congress and signed by the Clinton administration. But there was a process that led up to this and, sort of different versions of the act. Sort of in a nutshell, there were some who felt that this would be too much of an intrusion into the executive branch's foreign policy power. There were others who felt that the executive branch, and particularly the State Department, would never sufficiently prioritize religious freedom unless they were forced to by Congress. So there was an initial version of the act that was much more mandatory than what ultimately came out. It would have, you know, set sort of a, you know, a definition of religious freedom violations, religious persecution. If the, you know, a country was found to meet that standard, there would be mandatory sanctions. That's not what ultimately came out. What came out was a little bit more of a compromise. There is still a mechanism that I'll tell you about of sort of categorizing countries, but there's then a wide range of actions that the government is supposed to take. And our commission was created as part of this compromise, essentially to be somewhat of a watchdog over whether the executive branch was adequately, you know, exercising this discretion that had been given to promote religious freedom. So let me tell you just also a little bit about the other things that, that IRFA did, because we're part, you know, we're part of this broader mechanism. The Act, in addition to creating our commission, it mandated the State Department to do an annual report on international religious freedom. Some of you may be familiar with that report. Some of you may also be familiar with the State Department does a separate report every year on human rights around the world. The religious freedom report is an additional responsibility. So this means that in every U.S. embassy around the world, there is some foreign service officer each year who is responsible for doing the first draft of this report. And there's an office within the State Department called the International Religious Freedom, or IRF, office that sort of, you know, coordinates the report, and it is put out publicly. That office in the State Department is headed by an ambassador at large for religious freedom, who was also created by this statute, mandated to be a principal advisor to the President and Secretary of State on the promotion of religious freedom. That person for the Obama administration has currently been nominated but not yet confirmed by Congress. So that position is vacant, but there have been people in that position previously. In addition to the reporting requirement, the Act mandated the President, who has delegated this to the Secretary of State, every year to designate what the Act calls countries of particular concern, or CPCs, which is those countries whose governments engage in or tolerate systematic, egregious, ongoing violations of religious freedom. And then it gives some examples, but not an exclusive list, such as killings, detentions, torture, very serious violations. If a country is so designated by the U.S. government as a CPC, the Act then says the U.S. is supposed to take some sort of policy action to bring about improvements in that country, which can range anything from negotiating a bilateral agreement with the country to try to get improvements to ultimately some kind of sanction to issuing a waiver. So there's this designation mechanism, and part of our role as the commission is to recommend countries that we think should be so designated. Another thing the Act did is it included religious freedom to be a priority or an aspect among various sort of other U.S. programs, such as foreign assistance, cultural exchanges, international broadcasting, and it mandated the inclusion of religious freedom in the training of U.S. Foreign Service officers and U.S. Immigration officials, U.S. sort of refugee and asylum officials. And then, as I said, it created our commission, which is federally funded, you're created by Congress, federally funded, but we're not part of the State Department, we're not part of the executive branch, we're purely advisory. Our commissioners, we have 9 commissioners, and then a professional staff, including me, of 15 people. The commissioners are political appointees. They're appointed by either the President or the leaders of the Congress, 3 by the President, 3 by the leaders of the House, 3 by the leaders of the Senate, under a formula such that it's bipartisan, with 5 appointees from the President's party and 4 from the other party. The commissioners are, unlike in some other human rights institutions, our commissioners are private citizens. They are not U.S. government employees. They serve in a volunteer capacity. They're not paid for their service as commissioners. So there are other commissions in the U.S. government that do human rights issues where the commissioners are either executive branch officials or members of Congress, but ours are not. Our commissioners are appointed for 2-year terms. They can be reappointed, and the statute says they're to be selected among distinguished individuals noted for their knowledge and experience in fields relevant to the issue of international religious freedom, including foreign affairs, direct experience abroad, human rights, and international law. Over the life of the commission, the commissioners have come from a wide range of professional backgrounds. As I said, they're bipartisan, so from different parties, from a wide range of religious backgrounds. We've had people who have been academics, international law specialists, NGO human rights advocates, religious leaders, so really a broad range of people. Like I said, our mandate is to review religious freedom around the world and make recommendations to other branches of the U.S. government. This includes recommending those countries that we think should be designated by the State Department or the President as countries of particular concern. We do research and reporting. We put out an annual report every year. I brought a few copies, but they're quite heavy. Also available on our website. We also do sort of smaller reports, either on a particular country or a particular issue. This is on the defamation of religions issue that Paula referenced, which is essentially an effort by some countries at the UN to restrict freedom of expression and religious freedom in the interests of protecting religions from criticism or insult. We travel internationally. We consult with U.S. government officials, other officials, representatives of international organizations. We work with NGOs. We can hold hearings. All sorts of ways to gather our information. We, unlike Freedom House or the State Department, our annual report every year doesn't cover every country in the world. We cover around 20, 25 to 30. Essentially, most the ones that we feel meet this worst violator standards, the CPC standard, and then a number of others where there are serious concerns, but they may not necessarily meet that standard. This, of course, doesn't mean that there aren't other countries where there are religious freedom problems. It's just that as a small entity, we don't have the capacity to report on every country in the world, but the State Department does, and other religious freedom is an aspect of Freedom House's survey as well. So in terms of what constitutes religious freedom or religious freedom violations under IRFA, we are told by the Act to use the international standards. It's not an American standard of separation of church and state. The Act specifically references the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, and the other international instruments whereby countries have agreed to these standards, which we also believe are universal, although, as of course we all know, the application in specific circumstances is often contested. We do focus on religious freedom, although it's hard to separate that from a number of other rights. So our reporting does also address where there are sort of intersecting violations. I mean, you often see religious freedom is related to freedom of expression and freedom of assembly and association, and also there's often an overlap between religious freedom violations and violations of women's rights. So there are... it's sort of a broad conception of what religious freedom entails. In terms of the countries that we tend to focus on, as I mentioned, part of our mandate is to recommend this category of CPCs, or the worst violators. There are currently 8 countries that are so designated by the State Department. Those are Burma, China, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Uzbekistan. All of those are countries that the Commission agrees should be CPCs, so those are all amongst the ones that we have recommended. We currently also feel at the Commission that there are 5 more countries that meet this statutory standard, and those are Iraq, Nigeria, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Vietnam, although those currently do not have that designation from the executive branch. As I mentioned, there are other countries where there are religious freedom concerns that don't meet the standards. We've created what we call a watch list, where we report on other countries where there are problems. We currently have 12 countries on our watch list. which are Afghanistan, Belarus, Cuba, Egypt, India, Indonesia, Laos, the Russian Federation, Somalia, Tajikistan, Turkey, and Venezuela. And then we also, throughout the year, and in our report, we cover some other countries where there may be a particular issue that's come to our attention or concern over the course of the year. And over the course of the year, we'll speak out in public statements and things like that on other issues. There are a couple of other things that the International Religious Freedom Act did. One is it made inadmissible to the United States, i.e., inadmissible for entry into the United States, foreign government officials who have are responsible for perpetrating severe religious freedom violations. This provision so far has only been invoked once in 2005, when on a commission recommendation, the State Department revoked a visa that had been issued to the Indian governor of the, or chief minister, as they call it, of the state of Gujarat, Narendra Modi, who is actually still the governor of that state, but has been implicated for involvement or at least toleration of 2002 mob violence in which as many as 2,000 Muslims were killed. So that's one thing. We've also urged the State Department to maintain a list of religious freedom violators for the purposes of sort of a visa check, although we haven't had much success on that ground lately. Although recently with the Iran sanctions that were just announced, they did impose visa bans on a number of Iranian government officials implicated in human rights, including religious freedom violations. So sort of a related matter. Another thing that the Congress authorized USERF to do, and this is sort of the one area where we have had a bit of a domestic focus. As I mentioned, our mandate is sort of monitoring conditions overseas and recommending U.S. foreign policy, except that the statute authorized us to do a major research study into the treatment of asylum seekers, people seeking asylum in the United States under a U.S. program called Expedited Removal, which had been created a few years prior to the passage of IRFA, and there was some concern. It's a process whereby if somebody shows up at a U.S. port of entry without documentation or with insufficient, sort of fraudulent documentation or whatever, they are detained, and there's a fairly quick, expedited process of assessing their situation, and if they are found to not be eligible for entry to the United States, sending them back to where they came from. There was some concern in Congress that this process, if asylum seekers were caught up in this process, because, of course, asylum seekers often don't have proper documentation, when they fled whatever situation they may be fleeing. So Congress mandated the commission to do a study into this program. At this point, had been running for a couple of years to see, was there a risk that asylum seekers were being detained and improperly sent back to a country where they faced a risk of persecution. So the commission did a major several-year study that was released in 2005, which did find a number of problems in the way expedited removal was being implemented in the United States, and we made a number of recommendations to the U.S. entities that oversee that program, which are the Departments of Homeland Security and Justice, as to ways to ameliorate these problems. This is something, as I said, the report came out in 2005, but there was not particularly prompt U.S. government implementation of these recommendations, so we continue to work on those issues. We were pleased that early in the Obama administration, they announced some efforts to reform the U.S. immigration detention system, which is the system in which asylum seekers, among others, are detained, and that they were planning to make some reforms particular to the way non-criminal immigrants or asylum seekers are detained that track the number of the commission recommendations. So we were happy to see that, and we continue to work with the folks at DHS on getting those implemented. They are still ongoing, but we're hopeful that will address some but not all of the problems that we identified. So in terms of sort of the final issue, successes and failures. So as I said, we were mandated to monitor conditions and make recommendations to the U.S. government. The idea was that we were supposed to, you know, raise public awareness, raise U.S. government awareness, and hopefully push the U.S. government to make religious freedom a higher priority in its human rights policy. Have we succeeded? Not completely. I think there have been some successes, but there's also still a long way to go. As I've mentioned, we are an advisory body. We make recommendations. They are not binding. We have no power to make the State Department or the President or the Congress implement our recommendations. So like an NGO, we have to be advocates for our recommendations. We have to use our powers of persuasion, and so we have to sort of work with people on the Hill, people in the State Department. We speak publicly, raise public awareness, all of those things. And IRFA, I think, has had some successes. The entire structure has had some successes, and I think the Commission has had some as well in terms of the sort of structure. The designation of Vietnam as a country of particular concern by the State Department in 2004 led to an agreement with Vietnam whereby they made some significant changes, released a number of religious prisoners, stopped forcing people to renounce their faith, and made some legal changes that really did improve the situation there. We continue to think they meet the statutory standard for designation, although the State Department does not. But one must recognize that there were some changes on the ground in Vietnam that came about as a result of the act. There are a number of other countries where perhaps one hasn't seen such changes, or where we continue to see. China, for example, has been long designated as a country of particular concern, but I'm not sure any of the administrations have made religious freedom a particular priority in their whether the Bush administration or the Obama administration, our interactions with China. So there have been some successes and some failures. We also, work in different ways. Sometimes we're at odds with the State Department on Vietnam, for example. Right now, we disagree as to its status and as to the progress it's made. Sometimes we work on issues or countries quite closely on the defamation of religions issue at the UN. The State Department, the U.S., has opposed those resolutions and has used its diplomatic power and tried to persuade countries to vote against. We also have used our public advocacy powers and spoken out a lot in the press and in public about it, done reporting on it, as I said. And we've also, at the Commission, used our contacts with Congress to raise awareness on the Hill of this issue and the threat it poses to the human rights system. And in the last 2 years, we've worked with congressional offices to get them to write letters to various countries at the UN urging them to vote against this concept. So sort of complementing what the State Department is doing on demarching these countries, we've got members of Congress writing to the leaders of this countries as well. And I think that has shown some success. The support for the defamation of religions concept at the UN has diminished since 2008 to the point where it is now consistently, although the resolutions continue to pass, they're only being supported by a plurality, meaning the no's and abstentions outnumber the yes votes on these resolutions. I mentioned Iran. Iran has been a longtime country of particular concern for its severe and egregious religious freedom violations. But Iran, of course, is a tough country to deal with. You may have seen in the news that the U.S. recently imposed some new sanctions on Iran, some of which are consistent with USURF's recommendations. We've been recommending for a while, trying to do focused actions, focused sanctions, i.e. what was done in Iran, where particular people, particular government officials have been identified as being involved in some of the human rights and religious freedom violations that happened in Iran, and that those particular people are targeted rather than the sort of broad-based sanctions that target a whole country or a whole economy and then have potentially bad effects on the people in Iran that you're trying to help, the people that are the Iranian citizens that are suffering the human rights violations. So there was an act in Congress this summer, and then President Obama just about a week or so ago announced sanctions on 8 individuals responsible for human rights violations in Iran, and 6 of those are individuals who have been identified in our reporting as religious freedom violators. So those are some of the examples of things where we feel we've had successes, but of course there's still a lot to be done on religious freedom. Many of the countries that we report on have been on our CPC list and on the State Department CPC list for a long time. They're serious problems. You know, you have countries like North Korea. It's really hard to know how to improve religious freedom in North Korea. China's been a long-standing problem. So essentially, I think we feel like we've done some good, but there's still a ways to go. So I'll end it there and be happy to take any questions after the.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth, for that provocative overview of some of the very interesting developments that have been going on in the United States and your overview of what's been happening internationally. A couple of things to think about as we're moving through this session. The commission that Elizabeth belongs to is an advisory body, as she said during her presentation, and in this respect it actually resembles more than is the majority of commissions in the world or national human rights institutions the case, in the sense that the majority of human rights institutions in the world do not have the capacity to actually operationalize or enforce their recommendations and findings. For many in Canada, that might seem counterintuitive because, of course, we associate our commissions with the fact that when a commission makes a recommendation, it then goes to a board of inquiry or a tribunal or some adjudicative body that then in turn has the ability to enforce. And in most countries of the world, national human rights institutions that do have a statutory basis have primarily advisory functions and do not have the kind of enforcement capacity that what we associate with, for example, anti-discrimination commissions. So there's a good example of a model that is actually more typical of what goes on around the world than is the case in this jurisdiction, or than is the case with the American Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission, which does, of course, have that direct pipeline to the judicial system. So we've talked about an NGO, community-based or civil society-based organization. We move to kind of an advisory body that has a single focus mandate, although, of course, with certain overlaps. There was an interesting tension, I think, in some of what Elizabeth was saying between in the kind of freedom from, freedom to thing. Traditionally, we thought about religious freedoms and in the context of the freedom to practice one's religion, yeah? But a lot of the conflicts that have come up in recent years, and Canada's no exception to this, have been where religious minorities have requested the freedom to practice their religions or the freedom to engage in their religious beliefs in particular contexts. The obvious one, of course, is the gay rights issue. We've had cases in Canada where, for example, the providers of services like hotels and so on or bed and breakfasts, because of their own religious views, have refused to accept clients who are gay or lesbian, invoking their freedom of religion. These are the kinds of cases where the rubber sort of meets the road in terms of some of the ways in which we've thought about freedoms and rights will collide and create interesting challenges for the commissions that are asked to either comment on or adjudicate them. The other area, of course, still with us, unfortunately, is the issue of race relations, which often raises complex issues of social condition, past colonialism, ethnic origin, national origin, religion, and so on. And into this complex mess will wade Mr. Joris de Bresse. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is it de Bresse or de
Bresse?
De Bresse. De Bresse. Who is the Race Relations Commissioner with the New Zealand Human Rights Commission. I'd like to ask you to welcome him as our next speaker who will take us to the break.
Thank you. Ina mana, ina reo, ina hawaifa, tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. I greet you as people of the four winds of many authorities and many languages. And I particularly like to acknowledge my country people, Sir Eddie Tai Hakurei Jury and Donna Hall, and my daughters who are here from New Zealand as well. And thank you for the invitation to participate in this discussion. My topic is national human rights institutions and diverse societies, and it's really National Human Rights Institutions 101. To quickly give you some facts about what a national human rights institution is, then look at the evolving role of those institutions, look at the example of New Zealand, which is the one obviously I know best, look at some examples of other national human rights institutions, and then draw some conclusions from that. Can I also acknowledge the presence of Tabitha from the Canadian Human Rights Commission, works in a similar institution to my own. So what are national human rights institutions? They have a variety of names. They come as human rights commissions, as human rights and equality commissions, in many countries as offices of the ombudsman with a wider brief, and a whole lot of other terminology. They are internationally accredited by the International Coordinating Committee of human rights institutions, and when accredited by that committee, are recognised by the United Nations. They are an increasingly common form of human rights body. They started off in only a few countries, but as I'll come to in more detail later, in the early 90s, there was a workshop of NHRIs which set up the Paris Principles, under which such bodies should operate, and there has been a significant growth in the number of such institutions around the world, and pretty well spread over all continents. The particular place that they occupy is between government and civil society, so that's the kind of space in which we work. And what I think is the evolving role of national human rights institutions is that they are capable of being, they not always are, but they're capable of being a significant independent partner for UN treaty human rights treaty bodies in promoting compliance with international human rights standards. So they sit nationally in an international human rights promotion and protection system. So I've just got this little quote, which I was rather taken by a Danish author who studied national human rights institutions and looked back at the history and said that the idea that governments should establish and fund agencies which would develop transnational connections and possess a certain scope of freedom of action at the international level must have appeared strange in the state-centred world, which had only recently learned to accept the participation of non-governmental organisations. The fact that these institutions did not fit easily in the traditional three division of state powers, but appear to have a role in both the legislative, judicial and executive field must have confused many governments. Despite these peculiar characteristics, national institutions have spread to many new places all over the world since the introduction of the Paris Principles in the early 1990s. Some people have said that they, there is a danger that they have now become a fashion accessory for oppressive states. So let me run quickly through the Paris Principles, which were adopted in 1993 by the General Assembly of the United Nations. National human rights institutions must be vested with competence to promote and protect human rights. They have to have the broadest possible mandate, and it must be set out in the Constitution or by legislation. And their role is partly to advise government and parliament on human rights, to promote compliance with international human rights instruments and encourage their ratification, and to contribute to United Nations treaty body reports and cooperate with UN bodies and regional institutions. Our job is to assist in the formulation and delivery of human rights education and research programs, and to publicise human rights and efforts to combat all forms of discrimination, and even then, in the 1990s, in particular, racial discrimination. So looking at national human rights institutions and diversity, I would say in terms of a challenge that the primary focus of many national human rights institutions is often on broader civil, political, social and economic rights, and then a narrow focus on racial discrimination rather than cultural diversity, religious diversity, the rights of Indigenous peoples, and cultural rights, including the right to language and inter-ethnic relationships. So their focus often isn't on the issues of diversity and cultural rights and Indigenous rights, and yet diversity, religious diversity, Indigenous rights have become major drivers of politics in not just in Europe but throughout the world as a result of global migration. So there is a real challenge here for national human rights institutions to come to terms with these issues. So that is reflected in what I call the evolving role of national human rights institutions. And at the Durban Review Conference, which is the conference held last year in Geneva, to review progress on the Durban Conference on racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia and related forms of intolerance in South Africa in 2001. 37 national human rights institutions out of a total of 67 A-accredited institutions were present at the Durban Conference, even though a number of governments, including Canada and New Zealand, and a number of European governments and Australia pulled out of that conference at the last minute. In fact, some of us were criticised by our governments for attending for that reason. But our national human rights institutions met in Durban and focused on our own role rather than to try and to tell the world what to do. And what we said we needed to do was that we needed to engage with CERD, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and other human rights bodies more effectively. We needed, as national human rights institutions, to monitor racism in our countries, to establish focal points in our organisations to network and share good practice, and to promote national plans of action to combat racism. We needed to exercise our mandate more strongly in relation to Indigenous peoples, ethnic and religious minorities and other vulnerable groups, and to ensure that appropriate data about racism was collected. And we needed to engage with the public on racism and be accessible to victims. These were commitments from the NHRIs, as they're called, who were present in Durban. And I want to take you from that, which is a challenge to national human rights institutions. I want to take you from that to a workshop held last year in Bangkok about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, where again the national human rights institutions who took part called on states to establish national human rights institutions and enable them to address Indigenous rights, that the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights should promote the critical role of national human rights institutions on Indigenous issues, and that national institution should pay particular attention to Indigenous rights. So this was a call for NHRIs to look more closely at the issue of Indigenous rights. And they should be resourced to contribute to UN treaty bodies and the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples. As it happens, at the recent meeting of the expert mechanism in Geneva, only two national human rights institutions were in attendance out of those 67. And they were Australia and New Zealand. The Office of the Human Rights Commission, the Office of the Commissioner of Human Rights, should also support further regional and national dialogue on the Declaration. And I'm pleased to say that with the New Zealand Commission, a workshop is being held in Auckland next month for the Asia Pacific region to discuss those issues. Now, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination itself was a leader in affirming the role of national human rights institutions in monitoring and promoting the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. As early as 1993, they said that states should establish national human rights institutions to facilitate implementation. In 2009, They made a general comment in the follow-up to the Durban conference that states should cooperate with national human rights institutions in preparing reports to CERD and the follow-up of recommendations. And that's a picture of me with one of the New Zealand government delegation members at CERD. They have, in fact, now changed their rules of procedure in order to provide a particular and special place, independent place, for national human rights institutions at the table when their country's reports are being considered. So I want to take you to the country I know best, New Zealand, and take some quick examples from that about how we try to address the issues of diversity as a national human rights institution. And the first thing is that we have a dual mandate as a result of the amalgamation of the Office of the Race Relations Commission, Conciliator, and the Human Rights Commission in 2001. So our mandate is firstly to advocate and promote respect for and an understanding and appreciation of human rights in New Zealand society, and secondly to encourage the maintenance and development of harmonious relations between individuals and the diverse groups in New Zealand society. So we have a particular mandate in relation to diversity as well as the promotion of human rights in general. And we have a capacity within our organisation to address those issues. So apart from my own position of Race Relations Commissioner, we have a series of advisers, policy analysts, and Māori managers and staff, Indigenous managers and staff, who drive the agenda of diversity and Indigenous rights within the Human Rights Commission. And we have a series, if you like, of key roles in relation to diversity as an advocate, as a mediator, as a strategist, as a monitor, as an educator, and as a networker, catalyst, and facilitator. As an advocate, we do the things that many human rights commissions do. We make submissions to Parliament, we engage with government policy, we write reports and make public statements, and in particular, we also provide input into the country report to the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and the universal periodic review process by the Human Rights Council and other UN treaty bodies. As a mediator, we do provide dispute resolution service, but it is not a judicial process. It is a process of mediation. Our job is in fact not to judge, but to facilitate resolution. And of course, there are a series of grounds of discrimination in the Human Rights Act, which look at those issues of race, colour, ethnic or national origins, religion, racial harassment and incitement. As a strategist, we do a five-yearly review of human rights in New Zealand and also of race relations. And out of that, we produce an action plan for human rights, which has sections on race relations, refugees, migrants, freedom of expression, a lot of issues relating to diversity. And then we negotiate with the government on implementation of that action plan and work with civil society to achieve implementation. And as a monitor, we have introduced an annual review of race relations in New Zealand, which records what has happened in the past year and from that draws some recommendations for priority action. And in addition, as a monitor, we take the CERD recommendations about New Zealand and we monitor them annually for implementation and publish progress in terms of whether the government has or has not implemented the recommendations of CERD. That's an important measure which we also then report annually to CERD. I was very pleased to hear recently from Australia, who were talking to the CERD committee in Geneva, to say they actually read those reports. As an educator, we don't do much in terms of providing resources for schools because we believe that's a responsibility of government. But we have programs of community education, which we call Taku Manawa, which is developing community human rights leadership, to Hono Hono, which is bringing people together for human rights development in Indigenous groups, and Te Mana I Waitangi, which is our program of community dialogue on the Treaty of Waitangi and human rights. And one of our functions under the Human Rights Act is, in fact, to promote an understanding of the human rights dimensions of the Treaty of Waitangi, which is our founding treaty between the British Crown and indigenous peoples. As a networker and catalyst, we operate something called the New Zealand Diversity Action Program, which is a coalition, if you like, of about 250 organisations who must renew their participation annually and must be doing something. That's why the word action is there. You cannot be a part of it if you haven't got a project. And this year, those 250 organisations have about 600 diversity projects, ranging from, and the four areas that we describe as part of this, or the four sectors are government, government, which is central and local government, indigenous people's organisations, community groups and business. And the areas that we encourage action in are cultural diversity, racial equality, intercultural relationships, and treaty relations. So those are the four areas. And we have networks for religious diversity, for language policy, for media and diversity, and for refugee issues. And we basically ask people what they're doing. We put that together and send it back out on a monthly basis. And we run an annual diversity forum for organisations who are part of that process to workshop issues of diversity. And I was very pleased to see the youth delegates, the youth leaders forum here, because we also, as part of this, have a youth forum before the full forum, and for the youth delegates then participate in the overall event. As a facilitator, we have worked to develop statements, and there are copies of these actually in the foyer, of simple statements of religious diversity, race relations and language policy in a human rights framework. And so one has 8 points, one has 10 points, simple sentences which we think try to capture the key issues in relation to religious diversity and race relations and languages. And we've worked with communities to develop guidelines on religion in schools and in the workplace, and we facilitate popular input into the government's reports to the Universal Periodic Review and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So what are the challenges? One is the relationship with government, and you'll see the cartoon here, which is about me, unfortunately. What do you want to do when you grow up? When I grow up, I don't want to do anything, so I want to be a race relations conciliator. and I guess what that illustrates is that issues of race relations in New Zealand are very contested. Very contested. And some people hate me and some people love me. And that's kind of the way it is. But some people in government hate me as well as some people out of government. And when I went to the Durban Review Conference, I was attacked, and there were similar cartoons, by the Minister of Foreign Affairs who forgot that I was independent. But the profile of race relations issues is high. The public expectations are often difficult to handle precisely because we don't have a judicial role or even a quasi-judicial role. But people want us to punish people. Or people don't want us to punish people. But actually we just try to assist with dispute resolution and work with organisations in a positive way. And of course, as you'll know from elsewhere as well, our issues in defence of freedom of speech can be controversial and difficult to handle because of the way people talk about each other in the media and elsewhere. I want to take some quick examples from other national human rights institutions. Our fellow Australasian Oceanic Human Rights Commission has a similar commitment, perhaps even stronger. They have an Aboriginal Social Justice Commissioner. They are required by their Act to present annual reports on the status of Aboriginal social justice and native title to Parliament. They participate actively in the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples and the permanent forum at the United Nations. They have a race discrimination commissioner as well as an Aboriginal social justice commissioner. And they have a lot of projects directly focusing on diversity issues, including international students, Africans in Australia, Muslims in Australia, and so on. And they, like us, have developed a very active engagement with the CERD Committee of the United Nations. The Canadian Human Rights Commission, I note, now has a National Aboriginal Initiative. What's interesting to me is that this is partly an initiative to engage with Aboriginal communities who are now covered by the jurisdiction of the Human Rights Commission. I don't know how many projects there are about, and I know they're seeking to engage with the various Native American communities here to work out how that will operate, because it enables Native Americans to complain about their institutions to the Human Rights Commission. The South African Human Rights Commission has a recently developed project on non-discrimination in relation to non-nationals. This is the migrant workers who've come in from the north and who have been subject of major harassment and so on. So these are, and they are also developing an action plan on racism, but you may be able to hear some more from that later. So my conclusion really to this overview is that national institutions need to have a broad mandate that includes not just anti-discrimination and equality. It has to address issues of relationships. It has to address issues of diversity, whether that's cultural or linguistic or religious. They have to have a capability to address these issues in particular. It seems like a good idea to have a national plan or strategy in order to address these issues. There should be effective monitoring and reporting of what is happening in the country, which we do through our race relations report, but and the Australians do through their reports to Parliament. We need to work in partnership with civil society and with government, but we need to be independent. And we need every year to have projects that are taking us forward along this path. And we need to develop our relationship with the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, because we have the ability to be the national eyes and ears and voice of the international standards and the international standard bodies. I've got a final slide, which I didn't put on here, which I want to kind of conclude with, which is that I've taken from this conference is that we need to engage with some of the rights that perhaps haven't been so evident in the armoury of national human rights institutions. One of those is the rights of minorities. We need to think about how we bring that forward into our agenda. One is the rights and how majorities deal with minorities. One is the right to freedom of religion and belief, which is driving so many issues, for example, in Europe at present. And if we close our eyes to the fact that this is driving so many people, we close our eyes to the fact that it's actually leading to changes of government and increasing laws and actions to oppress religious freedom. We need to increase our attention to the rights of Indigenous peoples. It is not good enough for only two human rights institutions to be engaging at the international level at the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples. So we need, as institutions, to focus on those rights. And along with the right of freedom of religion and belief, we need to come to grips in a principled way with the right to freedom of expression. I think those are the challenges for us as national human rights institutions. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bresson. I think we've made an interesting progression from an NGO to an advisory single mandate organization to an organization with a broader mandate in terms of race relations issues, but that also connected with the international stuff. A couple of observations. By the way, are most people in the room Canadian? Anybody who is not Canadian, can you put up your hand? Sorry to target you nationally. Wow. Okay. All right. So for the, I was worried what I was going to say was going to be totally obvious to you, but then it won't be. So that's good. Canadian commissions, none of them meet the criteria that Mr. DeBress pointed out. No Canadian commission has the protection capacity to engage with the wide range of human rights that is set out in the international instruments. Part of the reason for that is that Canadian commissions were actually created prior to the development of the Paris Principles, even though Canadians, of course, were closely engaged in the development of the Paris Principles. And so they were developed at a time when this notion of commissions being buffers between national governments on the one hand and international bodies on the other, and being the conduit, if you will, and the interlocutor between the international and the national, didn't exist yet. Yeah. So the Canadian Human Rights Commission, I think somebody said there was a representative here somewhere. They may not want to raise their hands. It's you. Okay. Hi. The Canadian Human Rights Commission has actually done yeoman's work, if I could use that sexist term, internationally in terms of creating a place for human rights commissions internationally and thinking through what the role of the CHRC is at the international level. But it's really done it on the corner of its desk in the sense that there really is no statutory mandate for commissions to engage in this work at home, even though there is an expectation for them to do so internationally. This kind of work has added a huge burden to human rights commissions in this country that actually have not had the funding or really the institutional capacity to do this, but do it anyway because it's really part of their international work. So, and when I say that we don't meet any of the standards, we are notwithstanding that accredited as an A-status institution, as are many other institutions in developed countries that in fact don't meet the Paris Principles, which is a longer discussion that we're not going to have here. Another point to make about the relationship between promotion and protection just before we break, national human rights institutions must be able to both promote and protect human rights. Now, in the Canadian, American, Australian, New Zealand, et cetera, contexts, the protection mandate is often considerably narrower than the promotion mandate. And let me give you a quick example. There was a very controversial free speech case that was going on in Ontario a few years ago around a publication called Maclean's, that has a habit of, as for those of you who are Quebecers, will know that has a habit of calling an entire people genetically predisposed to deviancy. In this case, it was all of Quebecers. In those days, it was Muslims who were, you know, beyond the usual critiques of extreme religion, were castigated for being the that contemporary Islam was consistent with and indeed promoting sex with children and sex with animals. And this is not in some extreme right-wing blog. This is in Canada's, quote, national magazine. So complaint went to, which I'm going to rename Canada's Irrational Magazine, but for the reasons that follow, the Ontario Human Rights Commission at the time quite sensibly dismissed the complaint. It dismissed the complaint because they felt that part of, they didn't have jurisdiction. Huh? There's no speech jurisdiction in the Ontario Human Rights Code. However, on the promotion side of their mandate, the wider part of their mandate, in dismissing the complaint, the commission said, you know what, we don't have jurisdiction to deal with this complaint, and free speech is something that we value in our society, and this probably falls on the it should be allowed side of things. But we really want to point out the kind of distress that these kind of commentary, which is broadly based, repeated, and systemic within the magazine, is creating for those whom it is targeting. And we have a concern about that. And of course, you know, paleoconservatives went ballistic. But the interesting thing about the way in which this played out was that you had a national institution that was standing up and saying, that we're not going to go down the protection road because our mandate is narrow and we need to be careful about maintaining our institutional credibility on the one hand, but we do want to speak out and point out what the effects are of this kind of targeting on an entire people and its implications for this. And, of course, everybody involved in this discussion, including yours truly, were called a variety of names, which cannot be, some of which can't be disclosed publicly. But the and that also was part of you know, the engagement with civil society and the media. But the interesting thing about this, again, is the complex forces that are at play when national institutions need to engage on a multiplicity of levels with a series of different rights that often confront. So with those thoughts and those really, I think, valuable contributions, I'm going to suggest a 20-minute break, and then I'd like to come back and then have our final participants speak to you about their respective areas. So have a good break. We'll see you back here in 20 minutes. Which means 5-2.